Hey, it's John Harris, and I just got my True Diagnostics True Age test results, and boy, was I surprised. I found out my biological age is 0.36% of a year younger than my actual age. This is good because if my biological age were 5 years more than my true age, my risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease could jump by as much as 30 to 50%. Here's a kicker. 90% of aging is in my control through lifestyle and habits. It was so easy. A quick at-home finger prick, send it off, and in 2 to 3 weeks, I got a detailed report. The test showed that my heart and lungs are in good shape, but I could use some extra support for my immune system. It gave me tailored clips from Harvard and Yale scientists, like tweaking my diet and sleep, to slow aging and cut risks. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to TrueDiagnostic.com and use my code Harris to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use HARRIS at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you.
60% of people will avoid your business if you have an unattractive logo. This podcast is sponsored by Resurrection Design Company, which helps kingdom-minded businesses and churches fix that problem. Right now, they're running a special for the listeners of this podcast, a free website design for the first 2 people who sign up for a brand identity package. This offer expires the last day of this month, so get out your phone now and visit resurrectiondesign.co/matter to claim your free website design. The link is in the description.
Welcome once again to the Conversations That Matter podcast. My name is John Harris. And we have a special guest today. We're going to talk about a number of things. I'm not actually certain yet where the conversation will take us, but I know wherever it takes us, it will be edifying for you as a believer and for non-believers listening. Hopefully it will be convicting and help you come to a knowledge of Jesus Christ. And with that, I just need to make one quick announcement before we introduce our guest. We do have a conference coming up in Selins Grove, Pennsylvania, Christianity and the Founding. .com if you want to find out more. We also have a really great dinner that is going to be in conjunction with that conference. I would love to see you there. Okay, with that, let's start the podcast and let me introduce to you Ron Dotson. Ron Dotson is a hedge fund manager. He's there with the Dallas skyline in the background in the new founding office. And you can follow him on X, and it's very simple. It's his name. It's Ron Dotson, or on Substack. So Ron, thank you and welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me, John. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it was really good to meet you. Actually, I met you, I think about a year ago, but to get to know you a little better not too long ago as I was in Dallas. And, you know, you have a lot of different hats that you wear. And so maybe take a minute and introduce people to who you are, because I know you're a guitarist, you're a hedge fund manager. You give, you know, all this sage wisdom to people there in the new founding office. Who is Ron Dotson?
I'm a lifelong Dallasite, Texan. Went to SMU, played baseball at SMU, and then went to UT grad. My family business is in multifamily real estate, but really wanted to go kind of chart my own path for a bit. And so I in grad school studied derivative finance, went to work for a hedge fund, did that. And then I've been 1 foot in each of those areas for my career. I was basically a family office manager. So running an internal hedge fund for a lot of my career for the money that we were producing in multifamily. And so we sold the biggest part of that business a couple of years ago. I opened this up in which runs side by side to the hedge fund that I manage. But while all that was going on, I've always been very interested in theology and the where it crosses over with philosophy. I studied Latin for 5 years in when I was young, and then kind of taught myself Koine when I got out of school. Really have a huge interest in the intertestamental period, because I think as Protestants, I don't think the Apocrypha should be considered scripture, but it's interesting history. And but as Protestants, you know, we kind of ignore that period, and it's hugely formative to Christ's mission and interaction with the Pharisees and Sadducees. So that's, and then, you know, did some work with the Center for the Study of New Testament manuscripts. And so all that stuff is very, very interesting to me, has been for a long time. And I was encouraged to, I taught big Sunday school class at my church. I'm PCA Presbyterian officer in that, and my church. And so was encouraged to start writing, and I've been doing that for a couple of years now.
And you got saved, or however you want to phrase that. Jesus found you and you repented of your sins at a very young age, right?
Yeah. Well, my folks were divorced in the 70s. My mom was a beauty queen and my dad was a quarterback, and they got married at 19. And so, I had single parents in the 70s and all that implies, but my father, my grandfather on my dad's side was very devout. And spent a lot of time with him. He was born in 1903. So he was fireman for Bell Helicopter. He was chief. He was the fireman on the flight line. This was during Vietnam. And so he would wear the foil suit and go out on the flight line while they were testing the Hueys and the Cobras before crating them up to send them to Southeast Asia. And he was just a hero to me. And I saw him every night. I spent a ton of time with my grandparents because my folks were divorced. And I saw him every night reading his Bible till 1 or 2 a.m. And he encouraged me. He helped me learn to read at a very early age, reading the sports page, and then encouraged me to read and gave me a Bible at an early age. And of course, it just that he poured into me in a way that was completely a sign of God's sovereign grace. So it was really encouraging. And he loved people. His favorite thing was once he retired, he'd grab his wife, my grandmother, and me, and we'd go to the local mall and walk around, and he'd just talk to anybody who would listen about Jesus. And not in a manipulative way either, just in a, I'm so happy to be saved by the sovereign King kind of thing. And he's Southern Baptist. So I was baptized Southern Baptist and have a lot of, still have a lot of love for my Southern Baptist brothers and sisters. Even though I, by conviction of am Presbyterian, I had to accept John Calvin into my heart at one point. So that's a joke.
Yeah,
that's kind of who I am. All this, one of the things that really convicts me is as Protestants is that we are, you know, if we're not seeing our mission as a prophetic mission to the whole of the church, then it's kind of a LARP. Mm-hmm. And we can't just be a holy huddle. And so, and I don't mean giving up our distinctives. I think those distinctives are important. But their distinctives meant to, you know, the reformers really wanted to reform the church, and the protest was a part of that. And so that's a real conviction of mine. So I really am I want to be, without being, you know, liberal ecumenical, I'm kind of a big tent guy who still holds to the distinctives. And that makes for interesting conversations/arguments at times. But that's really what drives me. And I think a lot of the things that I study, you know, maybe play a part in that, the writing that I do.
Well, you write about a broad range of topics, and you have a very encouraging kind of disposition. And so I've noticed that you're on a lot of other podcasts that would be somewhat adjacent to this one. And so, you know, I'm sorry that you're kind of late in coming to the Conversations That Matter podcast here, but I want to... I want to talk about a few things we just obviously briefly mentioned before starting the show, kind of what you just mentioned about where Christians fit in, what Christians should be thinking of and doing, how they should be engaging the world around them. But the world around them is changing very quickly, and this is going to impact a lot of things that maybe someone like yourself, even who is looking towards the future, may not even know fully yet, because it's so volatile and so many different directions could manifest themselves. So I think a good way to enter this conversation, since you're a finance guy especially, is to talk about what's happening right around us, and that is the tariff issue. And every morning, there's new headlines about what's going to happen with the tariffs. One of the things I've noticed is a lot of guys on the Christian right, and maybe this is a good thing, who don't know a lot about economics, but they are in on the MAGA agenda, will frame it this way. They'll say the market economy was fake, and the money, it just wasn't real. We were living in a deception, and Trump is righting the ship. He's actually revealing, pulling the curtain back, revealing what our economy actually is like. And he's it may affect people who have 401ks and that kind of thing, but that's a good thing. It needed to happen. And so it's kind of like the guy who's overweight and needs to go on a diet. America needs to slim down. We need to get back into a more fighting spirit and a spirit of readiness and all of that. So that's not very helpful to some people who really want to understand what's going on, but that's how I've heard it framed. So why don't you just take it away and explain to us what's really going on, the thinking behind this, and then maybe broadly speaking, how does this fit into the globalist kind of or the global political situation that we have?
Well, I think what you said in describing kind of the down the line MAGA positioning, there's some truth in that, but I think what we need to hold as Christians, what we need, there's very basics that we need to hold on to. And so there is a Christian, I believe there's a Christian economic ideal. And that is, you know, from a very early time, if John, you had a goat and I had maybe a parcel of land, a tiny bit that of land or something I wasn't using, and we could trade, both of us would say thank you, right? And that's tied to, I mean, Jesus, even when he's saying the one anothering statements, there's an economic aspect to that. And so free price discovery and the arm's length transaction, I think, are endemic to a Christian economic ethic. I think that anything that gets, that moves towards, there's a reason that communism has to reject God, especially Trinitarian views of God, because it flattens out those. Well, we're reflecting perichoresis, the relationship within the Trinity itself. And so so when I go, you know, right over here across the street to this 7-Eleven, and the guy who, and I buy a pack of gum because I ate lunch and my breath stinks, and I give him, or I, you know, put my card down, and 7-Eleven gets a little bit of money, and I get my thing of, you know, ice, whatever, gum, both of us are better off, right? And that is basic, but hugely important. I think what is lost. So let's go further on. Adam Smith comes along and says, wow, look at the geopolitical world is set up in these nations that, due to where they are and who they are, have different advantages. And those different advantages are similar to the John and Ron meeting together and doing the double thank you. Can that be applied to nations as well? And the answer is yes. But what we forget is that Adam Smith assumed Christendom. He assumed an equanimity of presuppositions. In other words, that when Ron and John get together, we both have basic ideas of, you know, equal scales, and we're not trying to cheat each other, and we worship the same God and the value structure that implies. So a global, if we want to take Adam Smith to a global system, what that says is all those equal scales, all those sameness of presuppositions has to be erased. that's not important anymore. What's important is the what's truly important, and we can get, I don't want to get too super ridiculous sophisticated, but is the instantaneous liquid flow of capital across borders. That's what ends up being most important. And when you do that, then what you're really saying is those dollars or whatever the currency is, the dollar just happens to be the reserve currency of the world, and it still is. It may have been weakened a little bit. We can talk about that because that's driving some of this as well. That those currencies end up having more importance than the citizens themselves. And so that's part of what this MAGA, the guys who are pushing kind of the MAGA view on all this, that's what they're sensing, even if maybe they're not explaining it very well. It has to do with, I just wrote about this, what's called Dutch disease. And Dutch disease is, well, I think we need to come up with a new name, but it's the in Holland found in their territorial waters, I think late 60s, early 70s, a huge deposits of natural gas. And traditionally Holland is just a big farming, you know, traditionally farming, a little bit of shipbuilding, but mostly it's just a very diverse economy. And when natural gas was found, it so dwarfed the output, the GDP output. GDP's kind of fake anyway. If we get to that, Charles Haywood just wrote an excellent essay 6 weeks, 8 weeks ago on that. If you want to, at the Worthy House, if you want to go get a, you know, spent 45 minutes talking about how GDP is kind of a poor substitute for actual economics, and it's great. But anyway, natural gas in Holland dominated the economy. And it hollowed out all these other industries. And what I mean is all the human capital, all the smart people ended up going into this natural gas industry. And then when the natural gas kind of dried up, Holland was a shell of itself. And so that became, that thing is called Dutch disease. And the United States, especially since, so you had a kind of a three-stage way in which the United States has its own Dutch disease. Number one is, or maybe four stages, but you had the first stage was FDR for his own reasons. It was really to finance the three-letter expansion and the social safety net, social engineering project of FDR. He was the guy. Everybody blames it on Nixon, but it was FDR took us off the gold standard. Said the Federal Reserve is going to have basically carte blanche with the dollar, with the Federal Reserve note, which is what our dollars are. They're like a check written on, they're a bank note, and the bank is the Federal Reserve. The second deal was after World War II, and you had the Marshall Plan, which is where we basically financed the rebuilding of Europe. And we did this with this is how the dollar became, really started to become the world's reserve currency. And then the third stage is because of that Marshall Plan, and you had Bretton Woods, which was this way where all the other currencies were kind of pegged to this to a channel of value that was centered on the dollar. But we had exported so many dollars, there was no way we could keep this artificial peg to gold anymore. And so Nixon, really, his hands were tied. He said, we can't do this gold peg anymore. And then you had China enter the world. You have the creation of the World Trade Organization and China entering into it, to where everybody just said, hey, you know what? We'll let China build everything. So in that four stage process, the dollar became our natural gas for Holland, where it dominated the entirety of the economy, to where all the smart, not all the smart people, but smart people ended up wanting to be hedge fund managers. And instead of going into, you know, in the 1960s, if you were really smart and had that kind of mind, you were going to work either for NASA or one of the, you know, we were going to the moon, and we were going to, you went to work for NASA or IBM or one of the Manifest or Rocketdyne. Rocketdyne was the old, you know, they built the F1 engines for the bottom stage of the Saturn V. or you're going to work for one of these, you know, JPL or some type of industrial thing. And that eventually changed over time to where now, if you're smart, you're trying to figure out how can I write, program in Python in order to extract value using the dollar as this cudgel to the rest of the world. And it's hollowed us out. Why do we want to make anything? We're finance bros, you know? And so it's a real problem. And then there's all kinds of issues that flow from that. What accelerated this issue is you had, and the ruling classes is really changed from a classical, in the United States, better or worse, was never a traditionally rightist kind of place. You had traditional rightists, you know, Washington was kind of a man of the right, you know, he was part of the old royal line in England. And you see some of this, you know, a more perfect union is a call to, can we do England better kind of thing? Can we do a UK, but that is better. But once you had the Second Republic, which is what the modern, you know, we had the Articles of Confederation. Once you get to the Constitution and you have these co-equal branches and a Madison really pushing against any type of establishment. And Madison writes in his letters, look, I want to weaken the church as a whole so that it's not a political force. And that's hard for us mm-hmm. as conservative, you know, kind of as dissident right Christians, that's hard for us to hear, but that's just part of it. So these liberal assumptions were baked in. So we've got to just be cognizant of that. But it changed from classically liberal to this neoliberal idea. And the neoliberal idea is really that is multicultural. Citizenship really doesn't matter. That GDP, modern economics really says that John, you and me, we're not individual reflections of the image of God. We're fungible economic units. And Carl Schmitt wrote very cogently. I know he's a controversial guy, but his writing is fantastic. He writes that, look, if you're going to end the, it's either Crisis of Parliamentary Democracy. I think that's where it is. He's a guy who wrote Political Theology, which is absolutely brilliant. And then he wrote, Concept of the Political. But in Crisis of Parliamentary Democracy, he basically says that this neoliberal, he doesn't call it neoliberalism, but that's the move that was happening in the first part of the 20th century, that really if your idea is that all opinions are the same, as opposed to a discovering the best way to reflect what is true and right that's transcendent, then everybody, you've got to flatten everything out. So you get this deracinated cosmopolitanism that citizenship doesn't matter. What matters is how can liquidity flow as fast, you know, how can capital flow as fast as possible? So that's coming home to roost. That's what we're living in. And that's why citizenship doesn't matter. That's why do you care if all these people flow in by the boatloads? And my last point, oh, golly, I've been going on forever.
No, you're good.
But what really brought this to bear is in the Biden presidency and which was neoliberal maximalization, you know, which was, you know, kind of the extension of the Clinton, Obama. Interestingly enough, those two camps really don't get along, but they were different flavors of the same impetus, this neoliberal impetus. You had Putin invade Ukraine. And so what's the problem there? What do we have to do? And forget all the conspiracy theories, which I think have a lot of basis in truth about what was going on in Ukraine. Some, at least, some of the corruption. But what's the big deal? The big deal is wow, borders on the one hand don't matter, but they really do matter if this big the biggest advocate for anti-liberalism is going to cross one, right? And so the response to that was to basically shut Russia and the Russian acolytes out of the dollar system. So we're going to punish Russia by doing these things. And hey, you know, Russia, absolutely the aggressor. We can argue whether or not they were provoked or unprovoked. The answer is they were provoked. But that being said, that's my opinion, at least, that if when shutting them off, when you have this reserve currency, this American Dutch disease, where our chief export is dollars. Well, the problem is Russia's one of the chief producers of the things that trade in dollars. That's oil and gas. And so suddenly, when you have a reserve currency, the cool thing is you can produce all the deficits in the world and they don't matter because the rest of the world is this dollar sponge that soaks it up. And we cut off a huge portion of that. And that's what drove this massive inflation that was hugely underreported, unbelievably underreported. You can go to shadowstats.com and look at some real measures of what inflation did under Biden. So we caused this crisis that the neoliberal ideal probably could have gone on, I don't know, for a while, but kind of bringing this to a head in how we responded to the Russian incursion on Ukraine. So that's kind of I think that's a good place for me to stop. And then
we're good. Two things I want to explore. I think that was great. The first one is you had mentioned early in your presentation there that Adam Smith had assumed Christianity and fair trade.
Well, Christendom at least.
Christendom, yeah, that there was a sense in the market of we're not going to give you unjust balances and these kinds of things.
Right.
So I'd like to expand on that a little bit. How, because Trump has been consistent for decades saying that we're getting a raw deal with China, specifically, that they're devaluing their own currency to manipulate us. And I don't know all the ins and outs of that, but we've heard this for years. And I think in 2016, people weren't ready for that. They didn't understand it. And it wasn't a resonating message. So Trump, and I'm not saying that he did this strategically, but he became the wall guy. And that really resonated. I think this term, though, is now, this is Trump's baby. It seems to me like this is the term Trump wanted initially because he's been talking about this forever. So explain to us maybe what you meant by Adam Smith assumed Christendom. We don't have Christendom. And these countries that don't have Christendom are somehow being unfair. And because it's free trade versus fair trade, right? That's the distinction we're always seeing. What is that?
Well, there's a lot of issues there, and it's separate. The Asian question is separate from the European question. So let's do Europe first because it's a little easier. We rebuilt Europe with this Marshall Plan, and the Marshall Plan at some point had to end because you can't finance. It's like let's say you're the oldest brother, and your little brother is maybe not quite as smart, doesn't have quite the work ethic, but you figure you can. But man, you really want to, you know. You're 10 years ahead of him and you can help him pay for college and get him set up. But at some point, he's got to do his own thing, right? That's the European thing. So we look the other way with these massive, we were such a big and growing market. We wanted Europe to be a NATO partner because of the Soviet Union, not Russia, but the Soviet Union, these godless communists. And we were, even though that's kind of complicated because, you know, we partnered with these godless communists in World War II and that's a whole nother, that's coming to a head too, by the way. I mean, everybody's realizing that, wow, we basically financed the Soviets' victory in World War II. And that goes against we're finally able to start talking about that. So, you know, everybody, you know, the idea in World War II is, can we just keep a radical tyrant from running half of Europe? And we went over there and a lot of our men died and a radical tyrant ran half of Europe. It was just the other guy, the guy we partnered with.
Right.
And even more people died. Anyway, so we built this Marshall Plan, and and Europe was the younger brother that we needed to be strong in order to kind of counterbalance Eastern Europe, which was under the thumb of the Soviets. Well, the Soviets went away, and we honestly, we don't really need NATO anymore, other than just as we built up, we used an ethnic hatred. And I don't want to get into, there's stuff that I think is nasty in some of our circles that I don't want to get into, but our State Department in this anti-Soviet positioning became we employed a lot of people who had a natural ethnic hatred of Russians because it just was easy for them to do. And so we're still dealing with that. And so when the when the USSR went away, instead of immediately kind of partnering with the guys who ran off communism, we still had a State Department that was just really anti-Russian, and we're still dealing with that. Hey, you may agree with that or not, but there's some ethnic hate animosities that are still there that we're dealing with that you may or may not agree with. I personally don't, but a lot of people do, and I get that. That's what we have. So instead of this Marshall building up this little European little brother, for the purposes of helping him be big and strong to him and the Soviets, and the Soviets went away. And now, hey guys, you're ready to, hey, be on your own. We just kept building this thing. Mm-hmm. And now, so we looked the other way on tariffs and all these kind of things. You know, the French didn't want to compete with our wine. They didn't want to compete with our farming. The Italians didn't want to compete with our auto building. The Germans really didn't want to do that. The Brits had a bunch of tariffs. We looked the other way because the bigger thing is we need a big, strong buddy over there, a little brother to fight the Soviets and then the Russians. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's just, Trump is like, we're done with that. We don't need that anymore. Y'all need to do your own thing. And, you know, he's got enough people in his, he can't completely cut it off because NATO is this 800-pound gorilla that he can't do away with. And there's a lot of people who still hate Russia. And, hey, that's why we've got to build up, you know, we still got to have a strong Europe. Well, Europe, I think everybody can see, is a shell. You know, Germany's a disaster. The French are a little bit stronger because at least they have a lot of nuclear power, but still a little, you know, Spain completely depends on tourism and their coastal real estate. England isn't even England anymore. You know, I hear horror stories from London. Yeah. And so that's ending. What the end game is, I don't know, but Trump is like, hey, we can't do this whole deal where we just finance you and look the other way on tariffs. So that's what's going on over there. Asia is a different thing because whereas in theory, and also part of the European thing is Christianity's turned into this tiny little minority because they've imported half of Africa and Saharan Islam. And so we just don't have the same presuppositions anymore. Mm-hmm. It's like an alien place. And I'm sorry, I know, metaphysics, the neoliberals tried to outlaw metaphysics, but they didn't go away. We mm-hmm. still have to have, it's still real.
Yeah.
Metaphysics were always an alien thing for Asia. Always. We just had a different thing. And so with China, the issue is it didn't start with they're going to make everything. The issue that underlied the otherness of China, how did this otherness, this completely radically different presuppositional framework manifest? Well, it's this What's the term for it? I just wrote about it. Now I'm having a brain fart. But this idea that there is no propriety over the ownership of ideas. That is an alien thought, in especially among the Han. That's the ruling race of China, the Han Chinese.
So copyright, full disclosure, trademark.
I have two, my godchildren are both Chinese. So I have no disdain. I love all people everywhere. I really do. But I'm talking about the ruling class and Maoist communism is ugly. It's a special kind of gross, because you want to talk about people don't matter. I mean, they've starved 30 million of at least maybe 50 of their own people. Just didn't.
Reading a biography of Mao was the most horrific thing. And, you know, and I've read deeply about Holocaust stuff and Japanese treatment in World War II of their even non-combatants. It's despicable. But the worst thing I think I've ever read was about Mao and what Mao did to
struggle sessions and starving people. And
it's horrific. People
aren't people. And that's the communist thing. You remove God, you remove metaphysics, you remove transcendence. And this is what you get. You either get that, or in America, you get this rise of kind of a Nietzschean. Anyway, we can talk philosophy in a minute. But so in Asia, there's just no, we start trading with the Chinese, and suddenly all our stuff, there is no such thing as IP of intellectual property. And there's a litany of stories about I want to start a factory here and build this thing, and you can't because of regulation, and you can do it for 10 cents on the dollar over there. So you send a prototype of your product over there. Yeah, we can build this for you. We can do it for this. Great. And then you never see any product, and you're except on Amazon under a different name, and you've got no recourse. And this happens over and over. That's the small level. The higher level is, you know, stealth technology, atomic technology, pretty good evidence that the Clintons wanted that. And I know for a fact from, how can I talk about this? I did some work, some analyst work in the 2011, 2010 to 2012 timeframe, when the Chinese were starting the work in the Spratlys of building up, basically annexing the South China Sea. And the feedback from the Obama administration on some of this analysis, it was basically, hey, you know, these guys are going to be able to blockade Malacca Strait in a half day cruise from where they are. Well, now they've even built a naval base in Laos, but so Malacca's done. Anyway, Malacca's the strait between Singapore and whatever the island is. It's up Borneo. I can't remember. Right across the strait from that strait. And 30% of the world GDP goes through that strait. And the Obama administration basically came back and said, this is a feature, not a bug, of what we're doing. So they wanted all this. They really did. And I think the idea is if China builds all our stuff, then we've basically got a Mexican standoff. You know, we've got the world reserve currency. They make everything. We're not going to, you know, business partners at this level can't go to war with each other. Well, sure they can, because they also make all our drugs. You lose all your sovereignty. So anyway, that's the difference between Europe. The dynamic in Europe, it's leading to the same place, and the dynamic with Asia, specifically China, is, hey, look, if we're going to be a sovereign nation where citizenship matters, and these are Trump's big ideas, we need to be sovereign over our own deal. When we trade, we can't, do I think Trump's an expert on Dutch disease? No, but I think he has it in his gut. He does understand. And I've come up, I've dealt with him in business in real estate. Our lending team and his lending team at back at Lehman Brothers way back in the day were the same group. So I know how he understands certain aspects of these things. He in his gut understands sovereignty over a deal, that you have to, if he's representing the people of the United States, then he has to have some type of leverage in order to represent them. So I and all these other theories just support his gut. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I mean, the comeback is from the more libertarian wing, and some guys who would say they're not even libertarians, but they're operating perhaps that way, is that we are getting obviously a better price at a cheaper. It takes, sure. And we're not suffering some of the same social costs and environmental costs that China is incurring in order to make the products that we use in our homes.
Right.
And so this is a good deal for us, that the consumer is preferred in this. And so it, you know, Trump is trying to prefer United States corporations and businesses over the consumer. How do you think about that? Because that's the big critique that I see out there.
I don't know how he's supporting corporations. If he was supporting corporations, I mean, look at the response in the stock market. Look, the libertarian, and I was a member of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, read, I've got von Mises and Hayek and Hoppe on my bookshelf. Hoppe was hugely, hugely informative, informative to my thinking. So I appreciate those guys. But the big takeaway from Austrian, the Austrian based bedrock of what became libertarianism, is that you need a sovereign in order to guarantee these basic freedoms. You know, Hoppe is a monarchist even.
Well, and I just to clarify, I didn't mean so the corporations obviously want to build their factories in places where they can employ people with cheaper wages and that kind of thing. I meant like,
sure,
in the sense of Trump wants strong corporations. He wants strong businesses and to stay in the United States.
Right.
And of course, he says that he's doing this for the American worker because he wants to drive up wages and stuff. But the downside of it is that the consumers end up paying a higher price. And so in the end, we lose. That's the argument. And obviously there's things that are more important. That's what I think. Like, there's just things more important than getting the cheap price on some of this, losing out, as you, I think, rightly described, losing the soul of your country, having it hollowed out is a lot worse. But yeah, maybe explore that for a moment, because I know people are listening to people that are in our circle, sort of, that are saying this kind of thing.
Yeah, well, there's two aspects to this. There's the realist, kind of the John Mearsheimer, who I'm a huge fan of, the John Mearsheimer approach to things. And let's come back to that in just a second. And then there's the value approach. And so the value approach is what you're talking about, in that, look, is a nation simply an economic zone? Are we fungible? Are Americans not unique reflections of the image of God, or they're instead just fungible economic units? And so we measure everything as in the aggregate and damn the individual. Well, the problem is the libertarian should be the champions of the individual, right? The libertarian ideal is that the individual is the individual sovereignty, right? If you want to go full anarcho-capitalist, right? And so I don't understand. So, but again, Hoppe was great on this. In order for the individual to have any hope for sovereignty, there has to be a guarantor. There has to be a super sovereign in order to guarantee that. We know this from covenantal theology. If you're not dispensationalist, if you're kind of an old school, you know, Presbyterian or Reformed Baptist or whatever, you understand that every covenant has a guarantor. Otherwise, the covenant, a covenant can't be self-enforcing, not in the grand sense, because I could just, who's going to keep me from just walking away? Right. And so So on the value side of this argument, the idea is I've got to have something that the nation matters, that we are a unique people with a certain set of values that aren't determined simply by our desire to consume. That we are a people who have a certain, it's the founding documents said that these values are coalescing the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But that was assuming a Christian framework. So either, again, that metaphysical basis for things matters, and we have a unique way of life that is worth defending, or shoot, just do away with all borders. And if somebody loses their job or loses their, if you die, you die, who cares? Well, then the corporatists, the communists, and everything we fought against in the 20th century as Christians, everything, then the left is right. And really, all these basic things, Jesus claiming, I always remind people that the Great Commission that forms the backbone of all, of nice Christianity is the preamble to that is that Jesus says all power and authority have been granted to me. So the basis of everything we do is under the sovereignty of the Lord Christ. So that either matters or doesn't. That either informs what we're doing or not, but that implies a way of life. And so I think the neoliberal understanding is not just the other side of the same coin. It's not. It is the other end of the spectrum to this. So all that matters. That's the value argument. That's the worldview. And there's problems with worldview and all that, but that's the worldview argument that ultimately Jesus is saying that not only am I free, but I am. It's an ordered freedom that produces a unique way of life that will have different emphases and flavors among the different nationalities of the world. Okay, and yes, my postmillennialism is coming out, but I'm happy with optimistic amillennialism too. I'm a big tent guy.
So
now.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Well,
I was just going to say, I think what to put a cap on what you just said, the tariffs are economic borders. That's the financial border. And that's how you have to look at it. Okay, keep going. Sorry.
It's just, this is our sandbox, and we do things a certain way here because it's a certain way here because we don't have sovereignty over there, especially where people don't share our presuppositions. They don't share our metaphysics. They don't share our values. They don't share our way of life. And so there has to be some level of, Nick Land, who is not a Christian, although he's flirted with it. Nick Land has been brilliant writing about this for the last 30 years about if capital is fully moves at light speed without borders, then capital is going to be the God you serve. And it will destroy every aspect of any other God. So brilliant. Now, Nick is super esoteric, hard to understand at times, but he's been prescient, just a prophet in a small piece sense on all this stuff. Zeno Cosmography on Twitter used to be Outsideness. And I think he lost his... Nick got sick and lost his login credentials for his old Twitter account. I think that's what happened. Anyway, This isn't a podcast about Nick Land. Now, the realist view of all this, the John Mearsheimer approach, and John Mearsheimer is a absolutely brilliant professor of foreign policy, geopolitics at the University of Chicago. He's, I think John's Catholic. Go and look up he's given a bunch of speeches over the last 4 or 5 years on these topics. Brilliant, highly recommended. But he talks about that you have one foot in the values. What are our values that we have? But also, What are just the geopolitical realities? And the globalist, neoliberal, full borderless world is growing increasingly impossible to sustain. Why is that? Just for the simple mechanics, look what's happened. Suez has been shut down because of the Houthis in Yemen, because the calculus of how you fight is different than it was even 5, 10, 15 years ago. Used to, there was one, again, we talked about a sovereign being the guarantor of a covenant. The old covenant, not in a religious sense, but the old world covenant was of a borderless world because we were the guarantor. We have 10, 11 carriers, of which three to five are at sea at any times. And man, that carrier group could make sure all those choke points were moving easily. That's why, for instance, why is Turkey a member of NATO? Because Turkey controls the Dardanelles and the Bosphorus, the entrance in and out of the Black Sea. And they straddle that. So Turkey was going to be, we can't really sail a carrier group through that without their okay. So how about y'all be part of NATO? So this global soup, so to speak, was everybody had a seat at the, you know, had a spoon because we were making sure they could. There were no world or peer or near peer people who could, you know, have any hope against a carrier group. And we could send two to each ocean. Now, I'm sorry, with hypersonics, with drones, with everyone having access to spy sats, heck, even guys like me, if I want to spend the money, I have access to spy sats. There's 3-meter resolution spy sats that are commercial now that anybody can, where are we going to task it?
Wow.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. So, well, that's the big, you just go on Google World. Except you can get it updated, you know. Anyway, point being is the old calculus is impossible. So what's coming? Well, and Trump again, just in his, he's got a great gut, not just in size, but in but he gets the fact that the kind of, and he surrounded himself, unlike the last deal, where he, you know, he didn't exert a lot of, and he didn't know, he wasn't a politician, where he kind of surrounded himself with some enemies. He's got a great team around him now. And even, you know, like Scott Bessent, who I wouldn't make his life choices. We wouldn't agree on that, but this guy is an absolute stud. It's at Treasury Secretary. That guy is easily the smartest Treasury Secretary in my life since I've been paying attention to these things. Absolutely brilliant. Again, not one of us from a lifestyle point of view. Kind of hurts my presuppositionalism a little bit. And I'm kind of halfway classical and halfway kind of a half John Frame, half yeah. Gerstner. By the way, your talk on presuppositionalism a couple of months ago was outstanding. Everybody, thanks. if you haven't listened to John, and who are you talking to? Tyler on that deal?
That was Chris Bolt, I think.
Chris Bolt. Absolutely. Yeah. It was Chris, not Tyler Cox. Chris Bolt, absolutely great conversation. Go listen to it. You owe it to yourself. Anyway, but to put a bow on this Mersheim, this realism deal, that's why you see this return to kind of a Monroe doctrine, that why we put so much emphasis on the Panama Canal, because that is the one choke point we can control. There, we have, as a United States, we're blessed. We have the Atlantic Ocean on one side, an unchallenged coastline, the Pacific Ocean on another coastline. We have incompetence to the north and a narco failed state to the south. Zero challengers. And so we have three choke points that we have to worry about. Two are pretty easy, and that's the north and southern side of Cuba between Florida, the Keys, and the Yucatan to the south, and then the Panama Canal. And so we are going to be, by the way, today as we tape, I don't know when this will air, but as we are taping tape, listen to me, I'm old.
Tomorrow.
As we are streaming this, he is hosting Bukele today. So hugely important. Trump is at the White House. The kind of a Monroe Doctrine to where this hemisphere, North and South America, are ours. And this is making the Canadians very frustrated. And we ought to be, we should have some kind of kid gloves towards Canada. But I can understand the, I can understand some of Trump's, you know, brusqueness towards them, because they just got rid of maybe the worst prime minister in this, him. Well, you had a bunch in South America, but it's probably the worst that Canada has ever had. You know, his dad was pretty bad too, but man, Trudeau's terrible.
I mean, Greenland's part of this too.
Absolutely, it is.
Yeah.
The northern trade passage, if the world is warming, it may or may not be. I don't think it's really under much human control, but it probably is. We're at a kind of a, if you look over a long period of history, and you know, by conviction, I'm young earth, but God gave us all this history, geology to look at for some reason. So if you look at that and take an old earth view, it seems as though we're at a kind of a transitory low in temperature. So Earth is probably going to warm up regardless of anything we do. If that's true, the northern trade passages in a long term are hugely important. So that's why he's talking about Canada as a 51st state and Greenland and all that. But that's all Monroe. That's long term Monroe Doctrine. Again, I think Trump's gut on all this is just absolutely brilliant. Do I think Trump is looking at temperature charts? No, but he just gets it. I just really do think he gets it. He's, tell you what, the guy was brilliant in real estate. Mm-hmm. I mean, brilliant. Some of the maneuvering he did, I talked with Pete Canona's show about this, so I don't want to repeat myself, but some of the maneuvering he did to set up how he did some of his developments, to maneuver on the risk and capital stack. It's just, you know, very smart guy. Very smart guy.
Yeah. Yeah. What did Bill Maher say recently? And I can't stand Bill Maher, but he said, he went to the White House, visited Trump, and said, there's a sane man in the White House. He just plays an insane man on TV. And I don't necessarily agree fully with that analysis, but I think there might be a kernel of truth to that, that he says things that he knows he can read a crowd and know what reaction he wants. And he gets it.
So. Well, and the he's absolutely not a neoliberal. Everybody says, well, he's basically, you know, Clinton.
Yeah.
Maybe, but his gut is more of a kind of old rightist. I mean, people say he's a bit of a mercantilist. I don't think that's actually the case.
Yeah.
But he would definitely skew more towards that than,
I think he's, you know, where most Americans are, actually, in some ways.
Yeah.
Like there, we still have, I think, a very kind of old right instincts and soul about us in this country, most places I go. But we feel we have to justify them with ideology, and we can't really just come out and say that we want what we want. We have to figure out other reasons, and it leads us back down weird paths. And one of the things I was thinking about when you were talking, because I've been hammering the ideology thing quite a bit, especially as I see kind of this ascendant Christian right, and it can go in many different directions because it's pretty young. A lot of the people who are leading this are very young. And there's a lot of different ideas. There's a lot of people who would, I think, want to co-opt a group like that too. Mm-hmm. And I keep trying to warn people, just be really careful of ideology. Be careful of boiling everything down to one universal basic principle that determines everything. You know, not every single motive that affects someone or every single action that exists in the world is because of Jewish people, or because of it's yeah. it's the patriarchy, that's the, or because of fill in the blank with whatever
feminism,
whatever you want to say there. Yeah. I think one of the things that you've highlighted here is there's a lot of complicating things. There's a lot of history that's happened all over the world that has affected a lot of different things. And you can't really understand what Trump's trying to do unless you understand at least some of that. And, right. And so, you know, we've been talking for almost an hour, which is, I'm amazed actually at how fast that time went, but there's so many other questions that we could get into. I was going to ask you, like, in what sense is China manipulating currency? Cause Trump always complains about that. But I want to kind of give you the floor in the last few minutes we have, cause this, we really weren't going to talk about tariffs as much. That was going to be a sideshow, but that became the podcast, and kind of where the globe is going. You know, you kind of wanted to talk about Christianity and I wasn't exactly sure where you wanted to go with this, but I think specifically you said something about applying scripture and people who say you can't apply scripture or shouldn't apply scripture. So you can explore that with the last minutes that we have. Take it whatever direction you want to take it.
Well, just real quick, reflecting on what you just said about ideology, because I think it ties in. Ideology makes the same mistake that modern economics does. It makes the same critical error in that it flattens everybody out. It assumes that every human being, I can model humanity perfectly, our minds are limited, and so we're always looking for these heuristics that make the world comprehensible to us. And there's a certain extent to where the world reflects the infinitude of God. I make a living trying to model the financial markets, and that's just one tiny little bit. And there's always, you know, this unexplained degree of freedom or factor that's out there that could throw a wrench in things. So, you know, just as economics should be understood as a soft social science, that's how the Austrians really wanted to frame economics, getting back to the libertarian deal. And as it's become a hard science and made this and therefore deracinated and de-individualized humanity to the point of everything, so does ideology. Ideology makes that same exact category error, in my opinion. Yeah. It doesn't mean you can't have interesting ways to describe things that are in the aggregate, you know. But what I was, you know, just really convicted about just recently is that the online right, we need to remember that we serve, if all of this isn't about serving Christ, coming from a Christian perspective, if this isn't about understanding the mind of God and thinking his thoughts after him in a more clear way, then what are we doing? I sometimes think that in some of these arguments and discussions I see among so-called Christians, it's like Jesus is an afterthought. And I know that Jesus juking is always, you know, I don't want to sound like second grade Sunday school teacher, but really, I mean, this is all really it is about being faithful to to our gracious King, to our Heavenly Father, and being sensitive in a sense to the Holy Spirit, who is there to convict us of these things. And so for me, I've just tried to, for instance, on Twitter, instead of just being smart aleck S poster at times, which is, hey, there's a reason everybody hated the prophets, right? I'm not saying I'm a prophet, but if you've got something to say, it's sometimes there's a serrated edge. I know Doug Wilson once wrote a book called The Serrated Edge, and there is a right application of a little bit of vitriolic humor. I'm not suggesting that's not the case. Mm-hmm. But our chief, you know, I've noticed that, man, people are responding. I'll just do two or three threads a week of nothing super long, you know, but 7 to 10 posts of just explaining how as Christians, what's my perception of how we should think about these things. You don't have to agree with me. I'm just a guy, right? Mm-hmm. But if we can, how can we be God-oriented in these questions? How does the Lord feel about borders or about finance or about, you know, I'm writing about Holy Week this week, about, I hear a lot of people wanting to do the whole, especially my Bible church friends, doing the Passover Seder thing. So I wrote about that. Just how do we think about that? Is that the right way to approach these things? Or do we have something that's uniquely Christian, a new covenant way of thinking about these things? And the response has been great. And I think, again, the point isn't, when you're doing this, isn't to get people to necessarily agree with you. It's to get people to be Jesus-oriented, mm-hmm. to agree with God. And if you're just trying to build your own kingdom, sometimes I think that you're going to, and yeah, hey, building your own kingdom is profitable. That's a profitable enterprise, but it's not what we're put here to do. We really are put here to build Jesus' kingdom, to see what are the gifts he has given each of us as unique individuals, as unique reflections of his glory, that we might build each other up to love and good deeds, you know, working out mm-hmm. our salvation every day with fear and trembling, having an answer for, you know, every question, but with reverence and fear. And so those are the things that we need to always remember. And I think ideology, putting a bow on it, crowds that out at times.
Yeah, that's a good word. Something I've been thinking about quite a bit too, and convicted sometimes when I get away from that and I'm in theory land and I need to be able to relate it back to the reason I'm even here on earth.
And I mean, theory stuff is great. Here's right here on my desk.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and this guy was writing about justice. And his word for justice, same word Paul uses in Paul is the apostle of righteousness. He's always talking about the righteousness of God or from God. Dikaiosune, it's the same word. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Really been blowing my mind lately.
I quoted in a sermon yesterday, I was preaching at a church, Paul Tyson's book, Christian Platonism. And he goes through a number of these passages and talks about how Paul assumes some of these Platonic categories. And if you don't see that, then it's hard to understand what Paul's talking about. But 2 Corinthians 4, you know, towards the end and then into chapter 5, temporal world, spiritual world. He talks about these tents that we live in. He's, you know, talking about our physical bodies, but that we're going to inhabit this heavenly dwelling, and we're on our way there. And that's kind of the point, is all of us are on our way there. And what we do in this earth has an impact on even what will take place in the future. That should motivate all our actions. It should give us satisfaction, but it also should orient our lives to heavenly categories and higher ends. So,
amen.
With that, but
just because Plato didn't have all the language to understand it completely, just because he saw in a mirror dimly, and just because the Neoplatonic Gnostics took it in a weird direction, doesn't mean we don't have, you know, God didn't raise up Gentile prophets at times, small p. They didn't have the direct word of God and inspiration, but they were wrestling, really wrestling with these things. Sorry, I had to silence something.
You're good.
And so that's hugely, hugely important. I write at American Reformer pretty often, and I wrote a thing about the Socratics being, you know, the idea that possibly they were a type of Gentile prophet. You know, it's not as though when the Abrahamic and Mosaic covenants came along and the restoration covenants, that God just forgot about the Gentiles everywhere on earth. You know, God was still working through them. I mean, look at the wise men were probably Zoroastrian, you know, the maybe descendants of Jonah's converts. And God was still working in the Noahic covenant. It's interesting because we could talk about this. It would be probably fun. But Acts 15 is kind of a recapitulation of the Noahic covenant, the Jerusalem Council. And so, you know, we miss that sometimes, I think, as Protestants, because it's all about salvation. It's all forensics. And we miss some of these other richer themes that are also present in our that run throughout our whole scripture. But well, that's for another podcast.
We could do that. That's what I was going to say. We could do that on another podcast because you're kind of a Renaissance man. There's all these different things that, you know, curiosities you have that are actually highly relevant right now in the discourse that's in front of me all the time. So I really want people to follow you, though, if they're on X. And so if you're on X, if you're not on X, maybe don't go on X, actually. But if you're already there, follow Ron Dotson. It's just his name, Ron Dotson, and you'll be blessed. So with that, thank you, Ron. I appreciate everything you've said today. It's been really helpful.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you.
If you work in quality control at a candy factory, you know strict safety regulations come with the job. It's why you partner with Grainger. Grainger helps you find the high-quality and compliant products your business needs to inspect, detect, and help correct issues. And the sweetest part is, everyone gets a product that's as safe to eat as it is delicious. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.